I'd like to welcome everyone to Spotlight. Spotlight is a program here on ForThePeople.com in which we interview members of For the People. We've got a really interesting interview today. I'm looking forward to it myself. I'd like to thank Jennifer for stepping in for Terry today. Terry's voice is a bit under the weather, so he's going to be recording for us today. And thank you, Terry. And Shepherd Boy is recording for us also. Our buddy Dennis is taking today off. I'd like to ask everyone to please hold their questions and comments for our guests until the end of the interview. And as usual, I'll remind everyone that text messaging isn't permitted in this room. So with that, Jennifer, I'll turn it over to you to introduce your guest for today.
Well, thank you, Becky. It's a delight to be able to interview Rudy today. And Rudy, I'm going to let you pronounce your last name for me. I should have asked you that. When I first met Rudy and had talked to him a few times, he struck me as an awful nice guy. And then I found out he had a what I consider a truly fascinating career, and I felt he would be a wonderful candidate for Spotlight. So thank you very much for being with us today, Rudy.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for asking me, and hopefully I can get everything correct and shed everybody or attention to what I've done all my life, or for the most part of it, for my career. But probably the best thing to do is start from the beginning.
Agree. And would you first please pronounce your last name for me?
The last name is Salazar, S-A-L-A-Z-A-R.
Thank you. So where was little Rudy Salazar born in, and where was he raised?
Okay, I was born on July 9th, 1941, in a town near here where I'm living presently, called Concord, California. And I was raised in this general area here. My parents lived in Antioch, where I am now. They did a few changes as I was growing up there. They moved over to a little town called Rio Vista, about 20 miles north of us, and up in the Delta area. I'm in an area that's called the Delta. And on this particular island, they had the CPC, which was called, or was California Packing Corporation. A lot of farmland out there. So my dad worked out there with my uncle, his brother. He, my uncle ran the island. And in those days, machinery such as it was, they had migrate workers come up from Mexico seasonally and tended the fields, the hoeing of weeds, picking tomatoes and all that other stuff, and the various vegetables that they grew out there. So I kind of grew up on a little, like a ranch, had lots of room to run and play and hit a tree, knock myself out once in a while, but what the heck, that didn't stop me. And in between that, when I was 7 years old, they enrolled me in the school for the blind in Berkeley. And by the way, my oldest sister is also blind, and she had started the school, of course, about, I can't remember, maybe 5 years before me. And that was kind of scary because I wasn't used to being away from home. I got used to it real quick, which fortunately I've been able to do all my life, is adapt and get acquainted and do my thing. But I started there, started in the kindergarten, and by the first grade, I don't know if it was because I was started a little bit later, maybe that was a good thing. In the first grade, I did all my work pretty quick. In fact, my teacher recommended that I go from the first to third grade, so I did skip the second grade. and continued up to the ninth grade there at Berkeley. Got to come home on weekends because we didn't live too far. But the roads in those days aren't like they are now. Oh, my goodness. We've got 8-lane freeways each way going towards Berkeley into that area. In those days, I think maybe it was a 2-lane road. And going from Rio Vista to Berkeley, that's where I was living at the time, most of it. I'm only guessing because I don't remember hardly, but I think it had to take us at least 2 hours to 2.5 hours probably to get from home to there. But I sure look forward to the weekend when I could come home, and of course on long weekends or holidays, Thanksgiving and Easter, and of course Christmas, I was able to come home for that, you know, whole vacation time. And later on, when I was around, I would say 10 years old, I guess. My parents moved over to a town called Brentwood, where my dad managed and took over the Greyhound Depot restaurant. So we had that for 5 years before my dad developed a tumor in his back, and he was paralyzed from the waist down, and he passed away in 1955. So we had to give up that restaurant and Greyhound Depot. So my mom moved over to Antioch into a house that we had, a little small house, but it was better than nothing at all. And by that time, my sister was already in college. She was going to the University of California in Berkeley. So she wasn't home much. And my mom raised my brother and I. I being the youngest, my brother was between my sister and myself. And my brother graduated from high school, and he went off and got married, so I was home alone with her. And of course, I had the blind school until the ninth grade, but then I came into Antioch High School, a public school. And I graduated from Antioch High School in 1960. And those 3 years were really, really nice. I really enjoyed it. I was home with my friends, my cousins, and what have you. And in school, the first 2 years there, I used to wrestle when I went to the blind school. But they didn't have a wrestling team here until my senior year, so I wrestled. I won't tell you my record. I played around too much. I wasn't in shape. But I did participate in the band classes. I had dance band, and I had the concert band. It was kind of unique because I'd figured out a way how to march with the high school band. And, you know, they got to march in even rows. We had these big hats on that we wore for band uniforms with the plume on the front top of the hat. And I took some monofilament string, a fishing string, you can't see, it's clear. And I tied it to my buddy in front of me, he was a drummer. And I tied the other end to my hat. And we practiced, and I got along real well. I knew when to make the turns, and I marched in a band competition. The high school kids always participate in, and I don't think anybody even noticed that I was blind. I stayed right in time, right in formation with the band, and I thought that was kind of neat there. I played in the high school dance band and the concert band, and I had a lot of fun. Had lots of friends. We went out after the football games and did our thing. And getting back to blind school, I guess I kind of overlooked it. In those 9 years at the school, at that time I thought it was the most awful thing in the world. But, you know, you grow up and you realize, hey, that's the best thing ever happened to you. And it was for me. It taught me quite a bit. Typing, for example, it was a required course from the fourth grade all the way up through the ninth grade. And, it's, of course, it really helps now, being on the computer. And we did, like I said, in our sports, we had wrestling and tumbling, and I participated in all of it. We had a fine school. We shared it, a couple of facilities with the California School for the Deaf, which is right next door to us. The Deaf School had the big gymnasium on top with a swimming pool on, underneath, and we did a lot of swimming, and the football field was right there by our dormitory, but it was used by the deaf school, but we did our limited track and field events and had places to run and play. And then right behind the boys' dormitory, right up above there, was the Berkeley Hills. And we did a lot of hiking. That we got to know the hills up there pretty well. It was a little bit north of the Claremont Hotel. It's just beautiful country up there. I could imagine it was anyway. But I loved it. I stayed pretty active. Back to back to high school, I graduated in 1960. I attended the junior college at that time in Concord. It was called Diablo Valley College. And my main thing was to study music, because I thought I was going to go to San Jose State and become a music teacher and get my credentials in teaching. And the more I thought about it, I said, I don't think that's really for me. I didn't feel comfortable with it, although I did real well in my studies. I started thinking, what if these smart aleck kids start giving me a bad time, I'd slam one against the wall. That would have a job anyway. So I left that and went there for two semesters. Then the third semester, I enrolled in another college in our county. It was called Contra Costa County College over in San Pablo, right there by the bay and near Richmond in that area. And in there, they had a fantastic auto shop. And I was interested in cars because it seemed all through high school, my buddy's cars barely ran. But I always seemed to be the one that always had to fix them. And I found that I really loved it and that I could work on cars fairly easy. I really, really enjoyed it. So I went to San Pablo Junior College for a semester. We had to take a combined classes of auto mechanics and auto body shop. Well, okay, so be it. Got to learn a little bit about knocking dings out of cars and, you know, how to go about repairing a dent and what have you, you know, and sanding them and all that bit, and preparing them for painting. But my main interest, of course, was in the automobile part of it, is the mechanic part of it. So I learned quite a bit there about engines, and we had hands-on work, too, where guys, we lecture for the morning, and people bring their cars in, and we got to work on them in the afternoon. They had one of the finest shops at that time for equipment, everything at your disposal. I mean, you could bore an engine there. You could do brake jobs, turn brake drums at that time, and real nice kind of nice machine shop there. But anyway, I went through a semester there, and a friend of mine and I got together, and we went and bought a gas station. And that was quite a hilarious thing. Two rookies didn't know anything about pumping gas, and certainly, you know, even working on cars. So my mechanics were still real limited at that time. So we did service work like lubing oil filters and brake jobs, even that at that time was real limited, and a little bit of tune-up work. But we went through 2.5 years of that, and the state rehab at that time had gotten a hold of me, and they weren't real sure whether I would really do well with, you know, the automotive service end. But I went and did it anyway. With that service station, you know, and whatever experience I could get out of it. And my rehab officer came back one day and says, you really are serious about working on cars. I says, yep. You see the grease from my elbows down to my knuckles. I says, and I plan to do it with you or without you. And he said, well, I really feel bad. He says, you know, I guess I should have listened to you in the first place, and we'll try and help you any way we can. So they purchased me a couple of tools that I needed. One, an impact gun that you guys hear anywhere in a service station or in auto garages. That little gun that zaps your wheel lugs off of the tires, all that funny noise, you know. Well, they got me one and a couple little items, but then he finally decided, says, I think I'm going to send you to a school. There's a trade school strictly for automotive, and it's over in San Jose. He says, can you get away and are you able to go down there, spend the week, and then come home or whatever? And I said, sure. Well, during that time, I had gotten married, and my wife's sister lived in San Jose, so I had a place to crash. So that was no problem whatsoever. And I got acquainted with a couple of guys at the school real quick, and that also, you know, had to, they were from various different places, of course, of the state. And they had to live down there also. Anyway, one of my buddies that I got acquainted with come by every morning, pick me up, and always brought me home every night. So that worked out pretty good. And in this, I'm rambling on here. God, I hope I don't get this all messed up. But I took, it was an 11-week course. The first meeting of 7 weeks was fuel and electrical systems, which consisted of learning about carburetors. Fuel injection at that time wasn't even thought of hardly, I think, in the States. It had fuel injection on European models, I'm sure, at that time. But I learned how to overhaul carburetors and learned about fuel pumps and all the systems. And on the electrical end of it, we did tune-ups, learned about the ignition system, the coils and all that stuff, and how many volts it took to fire this and that. And at the time, we had points in condenser instead of electronic ignition. And so basically went through it pretty good in that short of time. And I really loved it. I liked that. That was back when we had generators more than alternators, and we had to overhaul generators and rebuild starters and all that kind of stuff. So then our last 4 weeks was all on wheel and front end alignments, which meant learning the what went into the car the other, as far as the powertrain parts of the rear axles, the drivetrain, what they call, you know. And we didn't go into the transmission part, just the axle bearings or wheel bearings in front. You know, that time we had rear wheel drives, no front wheel drives at that time. We learned how to do brakes and how to use the brake lathe and how to turn rotors and brake drums, and it was pretty interesting. And do wheel alignments, front end alignments, which I got pretty good at. In theory, anyway, I could do the work, and I'd have the guys read the gauges for me. But I did the actual settings and what have you, and they're not pretty good. Although front end alignments weren't going to be my bag either, so. And I forgot to mention in the electronic part of the session, we all studied for the California smog license. At that time was really getting into gear, and I don't know if they scared you more than anything else. Boy, well, you got to do this right, you got to do that right, you're going to go to jail, you're going to get fined, you got to be real careful. But we had the opportunity through the school to study and take the test and get our smog license, in which I was able to do both A and B classes at that time. So I was the only blind person in California that had a smog license, and I was kind of proud of that. You know, it was really cool. I could use that when I went to work someday in a regular dealership. But anyway, getting back to my wheel alignments and what have you, I just didn't want to do wheel alignments, but I did like brakes. I did brakes. I learned how to use the brake lathe and the turn rotors and brake drums, and I did it real well. I figured out my own system, how to use the machine without getting my fingers cut off. And I still have all of them, by the way. I didn't lose one after 35 years almost. But I learned that. So anyway, after I graduated from that school with pretty good credentials, I guess, or honors with as far as my testing and what have you. I was right up there on the top, practically. And came away from there with a big smile and had smog license in my pocket. And I would say, you see, that was in July, I guess, of 1966 when I left that school. And my rehab counselor called me and says, "Do you know Al Eames?" I says, "Yeah, I know. Well, I went to school with his kids." And he says, "Well, he owns a Ford garage. He's a good friend of mine." He says, "I took him out to lunch yesterday." And I told him about you. I told him, you know, that you just got out of school and you have a smog license and how well you did at school and blah, 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 and all that. And he said, "I'd sure like to place this guy into a job, you know, into getting to work." So Al says, "Ah, bring him in. I'll give him a job. He's hired, no problem." He says, "Oh, great. I think, you know, thanks, Al." I'm like, "Oh, you know what? I forgot to tell you, he's blind." I must have set Al back quite a bit, but he kind of looked there, and this is what my rehab officer was telling me. He had that little blank expression on his face. He goes, "Well, he's blind." He says, "I know who he is. He's busy with school with my son and my daughter." And he says, "If he did that well," he says, "I'll be more than glad to give him a chance." So I went there and hired on, started my apprenticeship August 17th of 1966, and worked the 4 years there and finished my apprenticeship and became a journeyman at that time. And I think it was around June of 1970. So there for about a year, almost a year and a half as a journeyman, I, you know, still learning things and trying to do my best. And Al retired and gave the business over to his son. And his son called me up one day, or called me into the office and said, "Hey, Rudy," he says, "you ain't making it, man." He says, "Hate to tell you this, but you're costing me money. You know, you're not, your production, your productivity isn't up to par." He says, "I tell you," he said, "but you know what, Rudy?" He says, "I don't think you'll become a mechanic one in a million chances. You got to just sell your tools and go somewhere else and do something." Well, I was kind of hurt at the time and shocked because I wasn't expecting that to happen, but it happened. He says, "But I think this is around August of 71, but I'm going to give you to November the 12th. Why that date is beyond me. So maybe you can pick it up a little bit and, you know, maybe you'll do all right." But by November 12th, it was walking time, so it's no big deal. At that time, it was a big deal, but I mean, I had two kids, had a new house I had purchased, so yeah, it was a big deal. I said, "My God, how am I going to do this?" But anyway, we managed. Had to collect blind aid for a little while, and I was off for 6 months, and I met some friends of mine that in a club one night where I was playing. I also do play music. And one of the guys worked for, at that time, was called Triangle Dodge. He says, "Why don't you come in?" And the service manager was with him too. She said, "Come on in, see what we can work out." So I went in there, applied, and did a job interview there with the owner. He says, "Okay." So he calls my ex-employer, who had promised me, and, you know, Al Eames himself, the dad, promised me, he says, "Hey, we'll give you a good recommendation wherever you do. If you find a new job, don't worry about it, no problem." Well, when my new employer called the other shop, his son Gary, who was running the show, told him, "Hey, don't hire him, man. So you're going to lose your butt." He says, "You're going to really be sorry you hired him." Beautiful recommendation, huh? So the guy calls me back and says, "Hey, I just talked to your ex-employer. He says I shouldn't hire you. Yeah, I'll lose my shirt on you." And I was really furious. So he says, "Well, I'll be back to you." I called the old man, he's Gary's son, dad, and I said, "Al, thanks a lot." He goes, "What do you mean, Rudy? What's going on?" I said, "Well, I proceeded to explain to him what his son had just done and the beautiful recommendation that he gave me. And he says, hang loose there for a few minutes. He says, I'll call you right back. I don't know what happened. I really don't know what happened, but he called me back. He says, well, you go ahead with your, proceed with your job interview with Mel. He knew the guy's name was Mel. So Mel, being real hesitant at the time, I figured best not to call him. So what I did, I just walked into his office or into his showroom. He saw me. I introduced myself. He said, well, he said, let's go in here and talk. So I figured if I cornered him face-to-face, he'd have to come up with something. So we sat there for a while, and we bickered back and forth, and I explained to him that I really don't know the system as far as the books. I said, bookkeepers can make figures lie and whatever, they can do whatever they want. I said, all I want to do is work. And he saw that, I knew a little bit of what I was talking about when it came to working on cars, so we bickered back and forth, and he started me at 70% of journeyman wages. And I tried to at least get him up to 75, but anyway, I started at 70% for a year, and then went to 75. I worked there for 2 years, and the union, all this time, it was a union shop in both places where, thank God for the union people. I don't care what you may say, anybody that has anything against the union, keep it to yourself, because I've got a beautiful retirement, and it helped me very well. But so much for that. I worked it for 2 years, and a union rep comes and says, hey, really, there's a place in Concord Dodge that's looking for technicians. So I went over there, and service manager had seen me before in a few night classes that you attend periodically, to get yourself updated on new features and whatever. But he says, yeah. He says, hey, you want to work for me? You can come work for me. He says, I think you might be able to show these clowns that I have working for me, how it is to really work. So the guy had a lot of faith in me, and of course that was a good break I was looking for. And he hired me, and I went to work there. So I said goodbye to the past and started what I consider the stepping stone that really got me into my career and really headed me in the right direction. And hey, I got to get journeyman wages all the way, $6.75 an hour at that time. And I worked there from 1974 to 84, because I went through three different owners in that place, but I still stayed there. And in 84, I continued in Chrysler. That's why I was working for Chrysler Company then, Dodge. But then I went to the, around the corner, there was a Chrysler store instead of Dodge, and I went over there from 84 till 1990. And I did pretty well. Had a few service managers in that time. A couple wanted to dump me and failed. Because my work was at that time very well, very good. My productivity was way up close to the top. So I did get my lumps and bumps, but I did place myself into where I could handle anything they gave me for the specializations that I did. So anyway, I went from 84 to 90, I went to the Diablo Chrysler, it was called, there around the corner. And then from there, a lot of our guys had gone over to a new shop that had opened in Richmond. All the top guys, that good friends of mine, shop foreman and all those guys. And I finally got to go to work with those guys. So our old buddies were all back together. That was the last leg of my journey for the career, from 1990 till when I retired. I worked in Richmond, California, and I think the first 3 or 4 months when I started, I was the top of the shop of everybody in productivity and production and all that. So boss couldn't pay me any bonuses, but the service manager says, hey, he says, you take your wife out to dinner on me. He says, it's not much, but service department will pick up the tab in our appreciation for what you're doing. So I did real well then. I guess I was doing okay all this time. I gotta take a breath, guys. Jennifer, how's the baby?
He's cooperating. Thanks for asking, Rudy. You are a natural-born storyteller, and I want to touch bases on a few things, backtrack a little bit. But I've got to tell you, I'm sitting here just feeling so proud of you, Rudy, and you're such a personable person. I think that between your great personality and your quiet sense of confidence and certain kind of dignity you have about you, you won yourself a lot of friends who supported you and all your talent and ability. And I'm just proud of you. And it's a wonderful story. But I want to back up to the beginning. What caused your blindness? Particularly interested since your sister was also blind. And were you totally blind as a child? And the ranch sounds like a beautiful place to grow up.
I was born blind. Parents didn't know it at the time that I was blind. But I have RP, which most blind people are aware of what it is. I can't even pronounce it, and let alone spell it. But it's a deterioration of the retina, which I'm sure a lot of our fellow FTP members may even have themselves. But I could see good light and a lot of shadows, and that could help me, get around quite a bit. So a few things I ran into, whatever, but at least I did have what I consider to be, a little bit of sight. All the way up to about 1991, my vision started getting real foggy and blurred, and they ran tests, and I had cataracts, so they removed them, put in new lenses like they do. But then after that, all I saw was just a bright white light with no images, no shadows, nothing that I could actually see. And as far as the shadows and images I saw when I could, they weren't strong enough to be able to recognize and identify anybody. All I could see was the shadows and what have you, but it didn't bother me. I guess being born blind, most of us kind of, you don't have it, you can't miss it. So I just, it was a good Lord was good to me. I was pretty lucky. I had some good times, some bad times, but I think overall I can't complain.
I love the story about how you managed to march with the band. I thought that was a great story. And I know you love music, but tell us what instruments you play, Rudy.
Well, thinking back from the time at the blind school in the third grade, they threw piano lessons at me. Not much choice in those days. You didn't walk and say, hey, I want to do this, I want to do that. They thought, well, this would be best for you. So who was I to argue? I played piano for 6 years. I took the piano lessons all the way up to the ninth grade, just like the typing lessons from the fourth to the ninth grade. Of course, I think the typing lessons outdid the piano lessons by far. But, in the third, fourth, fifth grade, they thought I should play a violin. Oh, that was really hilarious. Poor Roy Clark, he would have had a ball with that one. But anyway, and then I found a clarinet there in the band room, and I picked it up, and the band instructor says, hey, you think you can play that? I said, I don't know. You have to teach me. So I started playing clarinet, and I really liked it. I said, whoa, to get into this one, no problem. And it wasn't about 6 months later after I started playing the clarinet, I told my cousin, who was older than me, but he was the guy that everybody in the family and neighborhood always went to. We called him the mayor of our part of town. He was the guy you looked up to. He's the one that kind of helped raise all of us. My my cousins, myself, and the other kids in the neighborhood that were all good friends, take us camping every week and all that. But anyway, his friend had an old tenor saxophone up in the attic, and he talked him into buying it for me for $75. And you know, back in 54 or 55, that was a lot of money. He had a couple of kids himself and just working down at the local paper mill and what have you. But he bought me that horn. And I picked that up and switched from the clarinet to the saxophone, and I've been playing tenor sax ever since. And I really enjoyed it. When I got into high school, when I came from Berkeley and started high school in Antioch, there was a guy who became one of my dear friends who was about 4, 5, 6, maybe 5 years older than me. He was already 21. And he played guitar. I never heard of the guy, so I went over his house and we started jamming, and, you know, we could seem to play 4-hour gigs with 3 songs that we knew. But he was in the old Chuck Berry thing, and the guy really played some pretty good, decent guitar. So we got a bunch of guys together, a lot of friends that we knew, a bass player, and the kid that played drums. And so that really started the band thing. I think it was about maybe 5, 6 of us in there, and we call ourselves at high tones at that time. Then we changed it over to the Catalinas, and then that band got new members and lost old ones, and by 1961, I guess, or so, we were really actually getting some pretty good gigs, and we cut the band down to a 4-piece band and got serious with it. And I still play. I've played throughout the years and with many different bands, and like right now I'm freelancing, and I've played with 7-piece bands, which was really neat. Played with some country bands for about 5.5 years, and in fact, the last gig I had was with some good friends of mine. That it was a country gig, and I don't know. It seems like the saxophone kind of works out with their style of music, so I've enjoyed it. But music was always my second choice, and I said years ago, people would ask me, "Why don't you go on the road? Why don't you, you know?" And you know, Jennifer, it scared me to death back then. I guess I made the right choices, because back then it was, the drug scene. It's always been. Drug scene's always been around music as long as I can ever remember, and from the stories I've heard even before I was born. So I said, no, I don't think I want to go on the road. Because I'm going to be too weak. I'm going to fall into the same pattern everybody else seems to fall into. You get on the road, you play many gigs, you really need something to perk you up with to keep you going, and of course what that is uppers and downers and all that, so I stayed away from it. So I stuck with my mechanics, and I think I made the right choice. So, I'm clean, guys.
Well, again, Rudy, it is a fascinating story, and I'm sure other people join me in saying we're awful proud of you. You've done a lot. Man with a lot of abilities. How'd you meet your wife, and how many children do you have?
Let's see, I was, 13 years old, and me and my old buddy George Morris always had a habit of hitchhiking over to Pittsburgh and coming back just to go see, you know, various people that he knew. And he had a girlfriend in Pittsburgh, and he said, "Hey, we're going to go to Diane's tonight for a party. So, you know, I want you to come." So I did. We went over there, and his girlfriend Diane had 2 girlfriends there, one Mary and another girlfriend. What the heck was her name? Doesn't matter. I didn't marry her. And so they started playing music and dancing. The parents went to the show, and he finally said, go over there and dance with Mary. So finally did. So we got acquainted. I was still going to blind school at that time, but anyway, we kind of hit it off pretty good. We were little kids, you know, and we kept in contact. I'd write her letters from blind school. That was a good project in my typing class. And being that I come home quite often for weekends and stuff, I found it easy to, you know, keep in contact with her. And so we went to the show a few times, what have you. Then we kind of broke away from each other when I got into high school and didn't have time. I was having too much fun. So we went through high school and saw each other just, you know, just a moment or two. But then we kind of broke away until, I was about 1963 and I first bought my gas station. The gas station was right in the same neighborhood where she lived. She lived in Pittsburgh. And she'd come down and get gas. And this was pretty interesting. This is funny. People would come in, and you know, I was blind, and I'd ask them, would you mind reading the meter for me? And, of course, they all did. You know, I had all the people were real nice, and they'd give me the exact amount of change, or they got $3 worth of gas, so they had a $5. I took the word for it. There's no problem, which will bring up another story I'll tell you in a minute. But she had been coming in for about almost 2 years, but she wouldn't say nothing to me. And every time I washed the window on that station wagon, there was a little nick on that windshield. It felt like a bug, and I always tried to knock it off. And I just never could. That was something she always told people later. But her brother came in, and he says, my sister Barry comes in here all the time. I says, oh, yeah? I asked him what kind of car she drove, so then had an idea. Then when she came, I says, Mary, you've been coming in for almost 2 years. How come you never told me who you were? She goes, I didn't think it mattered. I said, well, whatever. So we started talking, and about that time, I was playing 6 nights a week at a local club in Antioch and working the service station, so I didn't have much time for sleep. She'd come in and hear me play. And so we started going out, and I guess since that time, we got married in 1965. I'm glad she's not here. But we have 3 children. My oldest boy, Ed, will be 37, June 25th. My second oldest boy, Anthony, just turned 36, June the 18th, last Wednesday. So for 1 week, they're the same age there. That way we had our own set of twins, but yet 51 weeks apart. Because when they grew up, when they were small, God, we dressed them the same, and people didn't know the difference, it seemed like. But then I had, 8 years later, after my second son, my daughter Maria was born. I have 3 grandchildren, two girls and a boy, ages 13, 4, and 4, yeah. Spread there, but anyway. So we've been married some 38 years, and that's the story on that one.
Oh, no wonder you keep bringing up typing class with all those letters. And tenor sax is one of my favorite instruments. I can't wait to hear you play someday, Rudy. Hint, hint. It's been a delight interviewing you. You made it so easy, and a wonderful story, a wonderful guy. And I'm going to throw the floor open to questions, Rudy.
God, I hope I didn't leave anything out. There's so many things I wanted to say. Just let me add that in 1999, I had a real bad left knee. It had been bad for quite a few years, and so finally came to the time where I had to have the complete knee replaced, which I did. And my doctor says, you should consider, you know, maybe retiring, but I hate to have you go back to work. He says, the other knee's getting kind of worn too. And that, of course, that was all from working on that cement floor, kneeling down, setting the racks underneath the cars, getting up, banging into things and what have you. And so I thought about it, and I checked with the union, and I had what they call the 85 plan, your age, versus, you know, added to the time amount that you had in the union, if you hit 85 or over, you were eligible for full retirement. Of course, I was. So I said, oh, cool. It's going to take me 6 months to recuperate anyway. And so I got my retirement papers signed and all settled out. And I was to retire by June 1st of 2000. Meanwhile, I checked with Social Security, and those were the stickers there, you know, because you have to apply for permanent disability Social Security, and usually they don't accept you the first or second time, and you have to get a lawyer and all this, you know. But I applied for that, and in a month I got a notice saying that I was accepted, so I thought, oh, that looked good. My retirement plan, my retirement pension, and Social Security can add up to practically what I was making working anyway, so why work? So I've been retired for this June, 3 years now, so I'm enjoying it. It had some low spots in it. I got kind of lazy, but after all that work, I thought, well, what the heck. I took a little time off. Now I'm trying to get myself perked up here and get myself going and get over to the gym, knock off some pounds I put on, and just going on now, doing some work on the house, and got to fix up the yard again. But that's about it. I'm sure people will have some questions for me and remind me of things that I left out. So. Okay, Jen. Thank you.
Well, we're sure glad you find time to hit the site too, Rudy. And you were going to tell us a story, a funny story, I think. Something about making change at the gas station.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that's... Yeah, the story that I was going to tell you about later was the time when, like I said, trying to knock that little pit off that windshield. She always tells everybody about that, how she came into the gas station for 2 years before I knew it was her. But that does bring up the topic about making change. One day, this car pulls up and asks for a couple of bucks worth of gas, and which I gave him the $2 worth of gas, and I recognized the car, because at that time I could tell the make and model of a car just by touching the fenders or whatever. This young kid had his left quarter panel all banged out, and it was all, you know, he had gotten hit. So after I had given him the gas, his girlfriend comes out of the car, comes around the back, says, could you give me change for a five? You know, I need 5 ones. So sure, no problem. So I got in my cash box and I gave her 5 ones, and she gave me back a $5 bill. I took her word for it. And what, you know, it was kind of slow that day. I was piddling around there in the shop end of it. This guy comes back up again, and it's the same guy. He says, hey, he says, I need 4 quarts of oil and 2 quarts of transmission fluid. Yeah, I says, okay, no problem. So I give them to him, and I don't remember what the amount was, but that's irrelevant. He says, all I have is a 20. I says, that's no problem. So I put 20 in the 20 slot and gave him the change, and then my buddy came in shortly after who worked for me once in a while, and he had the keys to the cash box, and he opened it. Hey, Rudy, what are you doing with these, with this one in the $5 slot and this one in the 20 slot? And it clicked immediately. I told him what happened. I told him it's Frank Giovanno. It's that punky kid that comes into that 54 Oldsmobile with the primer spots and, you know, smashed up left quarter panel. So I called the police, and they came over and they took my story. They knew who it was too. And the guy across the street, I got real acquainted with him. He ran a mobile station. I was running a Texaco station. He comes over and says, what's the problem? I told him what happened. He says, yeah, I know. He says, I was watching him. I said, I saw him come in. And I, you know, so he was like a witness at, you know, as far as to the police, that he saw the car in there. So just a few minutes later, after they put the word out on the radio, they busted the kid downtown. They found the oil in there and most of the change that I'd given him. So they knew who he was. The kid was a punk anyway, so they threw him in jail. You know, Judge Gatto threw the book at him. I went into court, and you know, explain what happened. And then there was another time, on Saturday morning, it was a Saturday morning, and this nice old gentleman that lived right around the corner, he was my customer, he'd open up for me in the weekends, you know, and he called me at home and said, Rudy, can you get down here? He says, I got a customer down there, he wants a tune-up, you know, on his car. So yeah, so I went down. I lived in Antioch, Pittsburgh, it was like 5 miles away, so I always called a cab. They knew me well, they took me down there. And I said, well, I'm going to go now. He says, you got it all under control? I said, sure. Well, when I first came in there, every morning, I always took a certain amount of money, and I'd open up my little tune-up cabinet, open up a drawer, and I'd put that money in there. What I did every day, I saved money for my sales tax, for my quarter sales tax. And I didn't know it at the time, but I guess the kid was watching me from outside. And so anyway, I closed it up, and foolishly, I didn't have a lock. But anyway, I went on there and did his tune-up and told him, hey, you got a couple of bad cylinders, blah, blah, blah. You know, he said, that's no problem. I'll get it taken care of later. So I did his tune-up and got some other stuff. And when he left, and well, the guy really blew it was he was telling me, you know, he says, yeah, I was down at the Sequoia Club last night, blah, blah, blah. Such and such was there. Such and such was there. And I said, oh, that's cool. Yeah, I said, I play down there once in a while. So anyway, he leaves, and I went back and looked in my tune-up cabinet for some reason or other, and I found, oh, my God, the money's gone. So I immediately called my friend around the corner there that had opened up, and he came over, and I told him what happened. He says, can you describe this guy? And he said, well, I knew this guy had a Mercury, and he used a credit card. I said, he used a credit card from, you know, with the name such and such, and from Oakley, which is a little town east of Antioch. So I called the police up and said, well, they'll be down as soon as they could. And meanwhile, I asked my friend, his name was Elvis Lane. God bless him. Anyway, he says, well, I says, the only thing I really noticed about him is he had a finger missing. I think a little finger on the right hand or something. I says, oh, that's cool. He says, he mentioned some of the guys that he saw down there, and one of them had to be a very, very good close friend of mine. So I called him, and I says, hey, I told him what happened. And I says, he told me he saw you down at Square Club last night, because he's got a finger missing in one hand. I don't know who he is. Oh, that's that Terry Livingston dude. And I told him what happened. He says, don't worry about it. We'll find him. He's a biker, you know, and anyway, thank God the cops in Antioch, I called and gave them the description or, you know, the person's name. They knew him also. They picked him up right away. He had a stolen credit card. He had stolen from some lady, and he used it, you know, to do the work on his car. And they busted him, too. So the only two times that I know of, you know, trying to get ripped off, I caught him both times. And if there was any other rip-offs, it possibly could have been a can of oil or two from the rack, or never had any tools missing. I think overall, I think I was, you know, pretty lucky, so. But those two incidents really do stick out of my mind, and they both got busted, so left me happy with that.
Gosh, they're great stories, Rudy. And again, you're a wonderful storyteller. I think, I hope lots of folks listen to this archive of your interview. It'll be a great inspiration for people to keep following their dreams and have faith in themselves. And you are wonderful at networking, too. So it was, again, a wonderful interview, and I really do thank you. Any questions from the floor?
Hey, Rudy, you were wanting to know how to say that eye disease you have? If I can say it, it's retrolenterofibroplasia. And then there's the one I have, which is optic nerve hypoplasia. But that's how you pronounce it, if you can ever get that.
I thought it was called retinitis pigmentosus.
RP works for me.
Yeah, that's true. I wanted to ask you too, Rudy. This is a wonderful interview. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And it sounds like in all the work you were doing, all the mechanic work you were doing, you really never used any modified tools at all. You used what tools everybody else was using. Am I right there?
Yeah, yes, you are. You're right. Everything the other guy had in his hand, I had. Only one time did I get a special tool made, and this guy was making up a tool for blind people called the torque wrench, which it gauges the amount of pressure that you tighten up against a bolt. It was a big, kind of a clumsy device, but put two D batteries in it, and you set the dial up to say, I need to torque a bolt up to 60 pounds. You set it for 60. It had a dial indicator that I could read. And you set it, and then as you torque, you don't jerk, you just apply steady pressure towards it. And when it reaches that amount of pressure, it had a little buzzer that went off, which was kind of nice. It wasn't real accurate, but I was thankful for it at the time. It was donated anyway. But any other tools, I had a nice running account with Snap-on Tools and Mac Tools. They loved us. Every week they got their 5 or 10 or 15 bucks, whatever it was. And as far as in my job, as far as doing, I did quite a bit of the tune-up work, where you had to have a scope hooked up or a timing light hooked up. I'd hook it all up. I knew where all the leads go and what have you. And it only took maybe a couple of minutes out of the guy that was working next to me or one of the other guys that did the tune-ups to run over and help me read the gauges, and I'd do the actual settings of the idle speeds and set the distributor where it needed to be. He'd take the timing light and read the timing marks for me. So employers had no problem with that whatsoever, because I was doing the actual work. So I got along real well with all that.
Are your fingernails clean yet?
Jennifer, if I may, I'd like to reflect a little bit on my attitude about blindness. I have almost zero tolerance to anyone that has to play the pity type thing. I just don't go for it. I didn't do that for myself, and I expect other blind people to accept what they have and to make a big deal out of it. And if you need encouragement, that's no problem. That's what I'm here for. I'm sure most of you and FTP are there also. So just wanted to put that in.
Well, it worked real well for you, and I'm very happy for you that it did. But we all walk in different paths, Rudy. So some folks haven't lucked out. But I do hear what you're saying, and that's pretty much how I live, too.
That was a great interview, though, wasn't it? Boy, I'll tell you, it was just... I just kept listening to all the things he could do. It amazes me. Well, I know that's a cliche, but it really does. And think how somebody without seeing at all could pick all those parts out and put them back in.
Well, thank you. I could keep every time you say something or somebody says something, it brings me up another story. But I did do a funny one. My neighbor here a few years ago had a Cadillac and the big four-barrel carburetor, so he needed it overhauled, and so I took it all apart, cleaned it, and we went around in his patio table there, and I spit all the parts out. I threw them all in a basket, what it was. You had to give them a carburation kind of bath, you call it. It's in some solution, real strong. And I said, did you watch take this apart? And I said, I hope so. He says, but here's all the parts, but I don't know how they all go back together. Should have heard of his expression.
I bet.
That's good. Well, Rudy, how did you come to find out about For the People? And when did you really start getting into computers, the way we're into them today?
Well, I really got acquainted with the computer when I was working in 1995. Our shop dispatch system went through electronic dispatching. They put up a few terminals throughout the shop with the screen and the keyboard, and it was set up so that each mechanic, when they got done, they had to write a story and everything, description of what they did for the job, punch off of it. Then the dispatcher, you know, had he entered all the various jobs to the mechanics, you know, for the what they were qualified to do. So the job would come up, and then you just go get you the next car, and automatically punch you on the next job. So rehab, I told him, I said, hey, I got to have a computer, I guess, in order to, you know, keep up and keep my job, or else I'm going to lose my job. So they set me up with a 486 DOS system and a couple of real quick lessons, and it was good enough to at least, you know, get me going. That's what I said earlier, that typing at the blind school all those years really helped out. So I got that machine, and then I moved to a different shop down the street, and it was time for a change, so they bought me this little laptop. I put it to rest for a while right now, but the one when I first started on FGP, I had my little laptop that I was talking on and using in Windows 95, so I had to get acquainted with that. But I really found that a lot easier than using DOS, for sure, for those of you that have used DOS. I never could get the hang of it. And as I went along, I liked that little computer they purchased for me. I'd take it home every night after work because I wouldn't dare leave it there anyway, and play with it and learn how to use the internet a little bit, email. I love my emails. And FTP, I can't remember, to be honest with you, I can't remember who told me about it, but I punched on, you know, came onto the site for the first time and kind of went through it and applied, and I said in a few hours or whatever, you know, we'll let you know. And of course, I was accepted. Thanks, Jen. And I've been on here since, I think, January, so. And I do appreciate all the tips you guys have helped me with. I still got a lot to learn.
Woody, when you got into the computer within your job, especially when Windows came out, I was on the phone when you said when you retired, so I didn't catch the year. But were there any programs out there to help you decide what was wrong with the car? Or had the computer tell you?
Well, the program that I used when I first got on at work on DOS was, what is it? Procom Plus, I think. Then when I got in the Windows 95 with my computer, I used a program that would work with ADP, which was the program that my employer was using, and that was called Eloquence. The state purchased that, and that was expensive. But I had Eloquence put in, and the guy that does all the computer work for me over in the city in San Francisco, his name is Peter Contesantis. I can't pronounce his name that well, his last name. Peter is an excellent computer technician. He amazes me as far as all the things that he does. But anyway, he helped me out quite a bit. And then he showed me how to use the programs and so forth. So I hope I answered your question.
What about when so many cars went to, you know, onboard computers? I know a lot of mechanics use the computer in the engine for diagnostics and whatnot. Did that throw a real stumbling block up for you with keeping up to par in the shops?
No, not at all. Through the years, as I went along, I went to all the schools that Chrysler had to offer. Not maybe all of them. I didn't go to transmission school. That wasn't my specialty. But on drivability, is the term that we use for the specialization that I have. I went to most of the classes and to learn the new features coming up. So I kept up with it pretty well. You know, all the new cars, they have codes. There are various codes that, that will flash on the dash or on through a diagnostic handheld computer that you plug into the car, and it tells you just about everything that's available on the car, from transmissions, how they act, and everything to do with the electrical systems and the engine parts as far as ignition. I stayed up with familiarizing myself with that handheld computer, which I even got to learn by memory what comes up first and so on and so forth, so I could walk through the menus and pick the spot I needed. Then I had one of my friends come over and he'd read it for me, and you know, so I was able to work with that, and I found it quite easy. I had no problem with it.
That's great. So if someone is listening to this interview and thinks they'd really love to get into the same line of work, you don't think that the computerization would be a major deterrent? It's still doable, huh?
No, on that part, Jen, and this is my own personal recommendation, okay? It has nothing to take away from someone's desire and ability. But I'm going to tell you honestly, the automotive field today is not for a blind person. And if there's anybody who has a question on why, feel free to ask.
I was afraid that was the case, but I was hoping it was better news than that when you said you adapted to the computer checks.
Okay, Rudy, I'll take the bait. Why?
Why? Because the amount of hourly wages versus the time off that a technician would have to run and help a blind person set up things, and it has gotten a lot more complicated since I've been off, although had I still continued to work, I would have kept up with it. First of all, you got to find an employer that's going to hire a blind person nowadays. I'm going to tell you, it'll be hard.
Well, I would think that the first thing that would probably enter an employer's mind is, if this guy gets hurt, he's going to sue. Or if I have a customer and this guy works on this car and something happens to them, then they'll sue. That's the first thing that comes to my mind.
You're quite right, Becky. Thank you for coming in. Liability. Now versus liability in 1966 when I started. You all know there's quite a bit of difference in that. And being able, I'm not saying that no one else is able or capable of doing what I did. I don't mean that or say that at all. It's just getting your foot in the door. Now we're talking dealerships, okay? That's what I worked in only, dealerships. Which is it's great. These are working for a company, a product. So I first started for Ford Motor Company, and Ford was cool. You know, I enjoyed it. But then when I got acquainted with Chrysler, the lease company of all that at that time that I thought I'd ever work for, I found out to be the best company that I enjoyed working. I mean, I worked on all types of cars, but I found Chrysler to be the easiest car for me to work on. Maybe not some others, but for me. And they had a good program. They treated me real well. They had good schooling. And, you know, it was just terrific. But anyway, like Becky was saying, yeah, it's liability. The liability part is really, really something. And it's and another thing, too, a lot of people say, well, why don't I just go into business for myself? Well, when you go into business for yourself, you're going to learn all the lumps and bumps on your own and your cost. I was cushioned a little bit when I started in the dealerships, because the dealerships absorbed any mistakes and what have you. Didn't make too many, you were out the door anyway, but I was pretty lucky on that. Comebacks was one of my greatest accomplishments, because you couldn't ask, or you couldn't find my employers to actually say that, oh, he had a lot of comebacks and this and that, because the magic word is comebacks, and I had very, very few comebacks. Little piddly stuff would, could have been over, to put it mildly, oversight. You know, even people that can see may forget to do one thing or something, but I never had anything major whatsoever, major go wrong with any vehicle I've ever touched. So, you got to keep down the comeback ratio and in order to survive. And I was lucky enough to do that. So, hopefully I answered or said what you wanted to hear.
Rudy, I have another quick question. I've gone to dealerships with people that have had their computers, their car set up to the computer. And I always hear this comment when they got it off the, line, is there any way that, someone that's not ethical can set those computers up to find something wrong, even though there's not? I tell you, I don't know how many times I have heard that.
I guess what you're trying to say is, can somebody tamper with the computers on a vehicle to make them do something different from what they're supposed to do? Not very likely, especially with the computers now. They keep record inside of everything that's done to them. The only thing that we used to be able to do was, if you had a computer that went bad, we could get into the new computer with our handheld little computer plug-in and enter in the current mileage that was on the vehicle, so that if this thing was ever checked, they could say, oh, okay, at 58,000 miles, this computer got changed. But the mileage record would still be the same. Now, this, I don't think so anyway, not that I know of. There was a time, I think, earlier that they were able to make some modifications for those people that had turbocharged engines. They wanted to boost up the boost a little bit and what have you, but for the most part, no. They're kind of almost tamper-proof, so I hope that's what you were asking anyway.
Yes, it was, because that discards a myth in my mind about what drivers are saying when they have to hit that to the computer, you know.
I know that most of the time you people think that a computer on a car, you're looking at a computer like you have, perhaps. There are no keyboards or no nothing. They're just little boxes to place them wherever the dealer, manufacturer wants to place them. One's the engine controller, which is a computer under the hood most of the time. Now they've changed them in different places. But just a little box, and inside of it, it's got a memory board, I guess. We don't do any of the work on the computers inside or internally. They have to be sent out to the company. There's just little boxes that the wire harnesses plug into, and all the data is fed in and out of it. It controls the timing. It controls the fuel injection system. It controls just about anything. The throttle body, which used to be a carburetor, got sensors there that tells the computer when to speed up or slow back or bring back the timing. Everything is done for you automatically now. There are no more timing lights as far as on the new cars, because everything is all already pre-arranged or preset so that nobody can tamper with them, because then you're getting into the end of the laws of smog, and you tamper and fool with anything with smog, you look into big trouble.
Rudy, It's real tribute to you. We've gone way over the normal time, and folks may want to hang around and still talk with you if you have time available. But I want to thank you again. Sincere thanks for a wonderful, wonderful interview. Thanks to Terry and Steve Shepherd for recording. Thanks to Becky for all her efforts of coordination. And thank you one and all for participating. Next week, Becky, you want to tell us about Spotlight?
Next week on Spotlight, none other than our own Bob from Wichita. So I hope everybody will join us next week for Spotlight.
I'd say one more thing if possible, and that's thank you for having me. Thank you for all of you for taking the time out to listen. And you, Jennifer, thank you for being the very first person on FTP that chatted with me. I'll never forget it.